Chapter 8. Debate over a robot. At the moment, Bailey was most conscious of the thud of his own pulse. He seemed to be living in a moment of suspended time. Ardeniel's expression was, as always, empty of emotion. Han Fastolf wore a look of well-bred astonishment on his face, and nothing more. It was Commissioner Julius Enderby's reaction that most concerned Bailey, however. The trimensic receiver out of which his face stared did not allow of perfect reproduction. There was always that tiny flicker and that not-quite-ideal resolution. Through that imperfection and through the further masking of the commissioner's spectacles, Enderby's eyes were unreadable. Bailey thought, "Don't go to pieces on me, Julius. I need you." He didn't really think that Fastolf would act in haste or under emotional impulse. He had read somewhere once that spacers had no religion but substituted instead a cold and phlegmatic intellectualism raised to the heights of a philosophy. He believed that and counted on it. They would make a point of acting slowly and then only on the basis of reason. If he were alone among them and had said what he had said, he was certain that he would never have returned to the city. Cold reason would have dictated that. The spacers' plans were worth more to them many times over than the life of a city dweller. There would be some excuse made to Julius Enderby. Maybe they would present his corpse to the commissioner, shake their heads, and speak of an Earthman conspiracy having struck again. The commissioner would believe them. It was the way he was built. If he hated spacers, it was a hatred based on fear. He wouldn't dare disbelieve them. That was why he had to be an actual witness of events, a witness, moreover, safely out of reach of the spacers' calculated safety measures. The commissioner said, chokingly,
"Lysh, you're all wrong. I saw Dr. Sartin's corpse."
"You saw the charred remnants of something you were told was Dr. Sartin's corpse," retorted Bailey boldly. He thought grimly of the commissioner's broken glasses. That had been an unexpected favor for the spacers.
"No, no, Lige. I knew Dr. Sartin well, and his head was undamaged. It was he."
The commissioner put his hand to his glasses uneasily, as though he, too, remembered, and added,
"I looked at him closely, very closely."
"How about this one, commissioner?"
asked Bailey, pointing to Ardeniel again.
"Doesn't he resemble Dr. Sartin?"
"Yes, the way a statue would."
"An expressionless attitude can be assumed, Commissioner. Suppose that were a robot you had seen blasted to death. You say you looked closely. Did you look closely enough to see whether the charred surface at the edge of the blast was really decomposed organic tissue, or a deliberately introduced layer of carbonization over fused metal?"
The Commissioner looked revolted. He said,
"You're being ridiculous."
Bailey turned to the spacer.
"Are you willing to have the body exhumed for examination, Dr. Fastolf?"
Dr. Fastolf smiled.
"Ordinarily, I would have no objection, Mr. Bailey. But I'm afraid we do not bury our dead. Cremation is a universal custom among us."
"Very convenient," said Bailey.
"Tell me, Mr. Bailey," said Dr. Fastolf,
"just how did you arrive at this very extraordinary conclusion of yours?"
Bailey thought, "He isn't giving up. He'll brazen it out if he can."
He said,
"It wasn't difficult. There's more to imitating a robot than just putting on a frozen expression and adopting a stilted style of conversation. The trouble with you men of the outer worlds is that you're too used to robots. You've gotten to accept them almost as human beings. You've grown blind to the differences. On Earth, it's different. We're very conscious of what a robot is. Now, in the first place, Ardeniel is too good a human to be a robot. My first impression of him was that he was a spacer. It was quite an effort for me to adjust myself to his statement that he was a robot. And, of course, the reason for that was that he was a spacer and wasn't a robot."
Ardeniel interrupted, without any sign of self-consciousness at being himself so intimately the topic of debate. He said, "As I told you, partner Elisha, I was designed to take a temporary place in a human society. The resemblance to humanity is purposeful."
"Even," asked Bailey, down to the painstaking duplication of those portions of the body which, in the ordinary course of events, would always be covered by clothes, even to the duplication of organs which, in a robot, would have no conceivable function? Enderby said suddenly,
How did you find that out?
Bailey reddened. I couldn't help noticing in the personal. Enderby looked shocked. Fastolf said,
Well, surely you understand that a resemblance must be complete if it is to be useful. For our purposes, half measures are as bad as nothing at all.
Bailey asked abruptly, May I smoke? Three pipefuls in one day was a ridiculous extravagance, but he was riding a rolling torrent of recklessness and needed the release of tobacco. After all, he was talking back to spacers. He was going to force their lies down their own throats. Fastolf said,
I'm sorry, but I'd prefer that you didn't.
It was a preference that had the force of a command. Bailey felt that. He thrust back the pipe, the bowl of which he had already taken into his hand in anticipation of automatic permission. Of course not, he thought bitterly. Enderby didn't warn me because he doesn't smoke himself, but it's obvious. It follows. They don't smoke on their hygienic outer worlds, or drink, or have any human vices. No wonder they accept robots in their damned, what did Ardenil call it, seafy society. No wonder Ardenil can play the robot as well as he does. They're all robots out there to begin with. He said, The too complete resemblance is just one point out of a number. There was a near riot in my section as I was taking him home. He had to point. He could not bring himself to say either Ardenil or Dr. Sarton. It was he that stopped the trouble, and he did it by pointing a blaster at the potential rioters.
Good Lord,
said Enderby energetically.
The report stated that it was you.
I know, Commissioner, said Bailey. The report was based on information that I gave. I didn't want to have it on the record that a robot had threatened to blast men and women.
No, no, of course not.
Enderby was quite obviously horrified. He leaned forward to look at something that was out of the range of the trimensic receiver. Bailey could guess what it was. The Commissioner was checking the power gauge to see if the transmitter was being tapped.
Is that a point in your argument?
Asked Fastolf. It certainly is. The first law of robotics states that a robot cannot harm a human being.
But Ardenil did no harm.
True. He even stated afterward that he wouldn't have fired under any circumstances.
Still, no robot I ever heard of could have violated the spirit of the first law to the extent of threatening to blast a man, even if he really had no intention to do so.
I see. Are you a robotics expert, Mr. Bailey?
No, sir. But I've had a course in general robotics and in positronic analysis. I'm not completely ignorant.
Well, that's nice,
said Fastolf, agreeably.
But you see, I am a robotics expert, and I assure you that the essence of the robot mind lies in a completely literal interpretation of the universe. It recognizes no spirit in the first law, only the letter. The simple models you have on Earth may have their first law so overlaid with additional safeguards that, to be sure, they may well be incapable of threatening a human. An advanced model such as Ardenil is another matter. If I gather the situation correctly, Daniil's threat was necessary to prevent a riot. It was intended, then, to prevent harm to human beings. He was obeying the first law, not defying it.
Bailey squirmed inwardly, but maintained a tight external calm. It would go hard, but he would match this spacer at his own game. He said,
You may counter each point separately, but they add up just the same. Last evening, in our discussion of the so-called murder, this alleged robot claimed that he had been converted into a detective by the installation of a new drive into his positronic circuits. A drive, if you please, for justice.
I'll vouch for that,
said Fastolf.
It was done to him 3 days ago under my own supervision.
A drive for justice? Justice, Dr. Fastolf, is an abstraction. Only a human being can use the term.
If you define justice in such a way that it is an abstraction, if you say that it is the rendering of each man his due, that it is adhering to the right, or anything of the sort, I grant you your argument, Mr. Bailey.
A human understanding of abstractions cannot be built into a positronic brain in the present state of our knowledge.
You admit that, then, as an expert in robotics?
Certainly. The question is, what did R. Daniil mean by using the term justice?
From the context of our conversation, he meant what you and I and any human being would mean, but what no robot could mean.
Why don't you ask him, Mr. Bailey, to define the term?
Bailey felt a certain loss of confidence. He turned to R. Daniil.
Well?
Yes, Elijah?
What is your definition of justice?
Justice, Elijah, is that which exists when all the laws are enforced.
Fastolf nodded.
A good definition, Mr. Bailey, for a robot. The desire to see all laws enforced has been built into R. Daniil now. Justice is a very concrete term to him, since it is based on law enforcement, which is in turn based upon the existence of specific and definite laws. There is nothing abstract about it. A human being can recognize the fact that, on the basis of an abstract moral code, some laws may be bad ones and their enforcement unjust. What do you say, R. Daniil?
An unjust law, said R. Daniil evenly, is a contradiction in terms.
To a robot it is, Mr. Bailey. So you see, you mustn't confuse your justice and R. Daniil's.
Bailey turned to R. Daniil sharply and said,
You left my apartment last night.
R. Daniil replied,
I did. If my leaving disturbed your sleep, I am sorry.
Where did you go?
To the men's personal.
For a moment, Bailey was staggered. It was the answer he had already decided was the truth. But he had not expected it to be the answer R. Daniil would give. He felt a little more of his certainty oozing away, yet he held firmly on his track. The commissioner was watching, his lensed eyes flicking from one to the other as they spoke. Bailey couldn't back down now, no matter what sophistries they used against him. He had to hold to his point.
He said, On reaching my section, he insisted on entering personal with me. His excuse was a poor one. During the night, he left to visit personal again, as he has just admitted. If he were a man, I'd say he had every reason and right to do so, obviously. As a robot, however, the trip was meaningless. The conclusion can only be that he is a man.
Fastolf nodded. He seemed not in the least put out. He said,
Well, this is most interesting. Suppose we ask Daniil why he made his trip to personal last night.
Commissioner Enderby leaned forward.
Please, Dr. Fastolf,
he muttered.
It is not proper to—
You need not be concerned, Commissioner,
said Fastolf, his thin lips curving back in something that looked like a smile but wasn't.
I am certain that Daniil's answer will not offend your sensibilities or those of Mr. Bailey. Won't you tell us, Daniil?
R. Daniil said, Elijah's wife, Jessie, left the apartment last night on friendly terms with me. It was quite obvious that she had no reason for thinking me to be other than human. She returned to the apartment knowing I was a robot. The obvious conclusion is that the information to that effect exists outside the apartment. It followed that my conversation with Elijah last night had been overheard. In no other way could the secret of my true nature have become common knowledge. Elijah told me that the apartments were well insulated. We spoke together in low voices. Ordinary eavesdropping would not do. Still, it was known that Elijah is a policeman. If a conspiracy exists within the city, sufficiently well organized to have planned the murder of Dr. Sarton, they may well have been aware that Elijah had been placed in charge of the murder investigation. It would fall within the realm of possibility then, even of probability, that his apartment had been spy-beamed. I searched the apartment as well as I could after Elijah and Jesse had gone to bed, but could find no transmitter. This complicated matters. A focused duo-beam could do the trick even in the absence of a transmitter, but that requires rather elaborate equipment. Analysis of the situation led to the following conclusion. The one place where a city dweller can do almost anything without being disturbed or questioned is in the personals. He could even set up a duo-beam. The custom of absolute privacy in the personals is very strong, and other men would not even look at him. The section personal is quite close to Elijah's apartment, so that the distance factor is not important. a suitcase model could be used. I went to the personal to investigate.
"What did you find?" asked Bailey quickly.
"Nothing, Elijah. No sign of a duo beam." Dr. Fastolf said,
"Well, Mr. Bailey, does this sound reasonable to you?"
But Bailey's uncertainty was gone now. He said, "Reasonable as far as it goes, perhaps, but it stops short of perfection by a hell of a way. What he doesn't know is that my wife told me where she got the information and when. She learned he was a robot shortly after she left the house. Even then, the rumor had been circulating for hours. So the fact that he was a robot could not have leaked out through spying on our last evening's conversation."
"Nevertheless," said Dr. Fastolf, "his action last night of going to the personal stands explained, I think."
"But something is brought up that is not explained," retorted Bailey heatedly. "When, where, and how was the leak? How did the news get about that there was a spacer robot in the city? As far as I know, only two of us knew about the deal, Commissioner Enderby and myself, and we told no one. Commissioner, did anybody else in the department know?"
"No,"
said Enderby anxiously.
"Not even the mayor. Only we and Dr. Fastolf."
"And he," added Bailey, pointing.
"I?" asked R. Daniil.
"Why not?"
"I was with you at all times, Elijah."
"You were not!" cried Bailey fiercely. "I was in personal for half an hour or more before we went to my apartment. During that time, we two were completely out of contact with one another. It was then that you got in touch with your group in the city."
"What group?"
asked Fastolf.
And,
"What group?"
echoed Commissioner Enderby almost simultaneously. Bailey rose from his chair and turned to the trimensic receiver.
"Commissioner, I want you to listen closely to this. Tell me if it doesn't all fall into a pattern. A murder is reported, and by a curious coincidence, it happens just as you are entering Spacetown to keep an appointment with the murdered man. You are shown the corpse of something supposed to be human, but the corpse has since been disposed of and is not available for close examination. The spacers insist an Earthman did the killing, even though the only way they can make such an accusation stick is to suppose that a city man had left the city and cut cross-country to Spacetown alone and at night. You know damn well how unlikely that is. Next, they send a supposed robot into the city. In fact, they insist on sending him. The first thing the robot does is to threaten a crowd of human beings with a blaster. The second is to set in motion the rumor that there is a spacer robot in the city. In fact, the rumor is so specific that Jesse told me it was known that he was working with the police. That means that before long, it will be known that it was the robot who handled the blaster. Maybe even now the rumor is spreading across the East Vat country and down the Long Island hydroponic plants that there's a killer robot on the loose."
"This is impossible. Impossible,"
groaned Enderby. "No, it isn't. It's exactly what's happening, Commissioner. Don't you see it? There's a conspiracy in the city, all right, but it's run from Spacetown. The spacers want to be able to report a murder. They want riots. They want an assault on Spacetown. The worse things get, the better the incident, and spacer ships come down and occupy the cities of Earth."
Fastolf said mildly,
"We had an excuse in the barrier riots of 25 years ago."
"You weren't ready then. You are now." Bailey's heart was pounding madly.
"This is quite a complicated plot you're attributing to us, Mr. Bailey. If we wanted to occupy Earth, we could do so in much simpler fashion."
"Maybe not, Dr. Fastolf. Your so-called robot told me that public opinion concerning Earth is by no means unified on your outer worlds. I think he was telling the truth at that time, anyway. Maybe an outright occupation wouldn't sit well with the people at home. Maybe an incident is an absolute necessity. A good, shocking incident."
"Like a murder, eh? Is that it? You'll admit it would have to be a pretended murder. You won't suggest, I hope, that we'd really kill one of ourselves for the sake of an incident. You built a robot to look like Dr. Sarton, blasted the robot and showed the remains to Commissioner Enderby."
"And then,"
said Dr. Fastolf,
"having used R. Daniil to impersonate Dr. Sarton in the false murder, we have to use Dr. Sarton to impersonate R. Daniil in the false investigation of the false murder."
"Exactly. I am telling you this in the presence of a witness who is not here in the flesh, and whom you cannot blast out of existence, and who is important enough to be believed by the city government and by Washington itself. We will be prepared for you, and we know what your intentions are. If necessary, our government will report directly to your people, expose the situation for exactly what it is. I doubt if this sort of interstellar rape will be tolerated."
Fastolf shook his head.
"Please, Mr. Bailey, you are being unreasonable. Really, you have the most astonishing notions. Suppose now, just quietly suppose, that R. Daniil is really R. Daniil. Suppose he is actually a robot. Wouldn't it follow that the corpse Commissioner Enderby saw was really Dr. Sarton? It would be scarcely reasonable to believe that the corpse were still another robot. Commissioner Enderby witnessed R. Daniil under construction and can vouch for the fact that only one existed."
"If it comes to that," said Bailey stubbornly, "the Commissioner is not a robotics expert. You might have had a dozen such robots."
"Stick to the point, Mr. Bailey. What if R. Daniil is really R. Daniil? Would not the entire structure of your reasoning fall to the ground? Would you have further basis for your belief in this completely melodramatic and implausible interstellar plot you have constructed?"
"If he is a robot, I say he is human."
"Yet you haven't really investigated the problem, Mr. Bailey," said Fastolf. "To differentiate a robot, even a very humanoid robot, from a human being, it isn't necessary to make elaborately shaky deductions from little things he says and does. For instance, have you tried sticking a pin into R. Daniil?"
"What?" Bailey's mouth fell open.
"Well, it's a simple experiment. There are others, perhaps not quite so simple. His skin and hair look real, but have you tried looking at them under adequate magnification? Then again, he seems to breathe, particularly when he is using air to talk, but have you noticed that his breathing is irregular, that minutes may go by during which he has no breath at all? You might even have trapped some of his expired air and measured the carbon dioxide content. You might have tried to draw a sample of blood. You might have tried to detect a pulse in his wrist or a heartbeat under his shirt. Do you see what I mean, Mr. Bailey?"
"That's just talk," said Bailey, uneasily. "I'm not going to be bluffed. I might have tried any of those things, but do you suppose this alleged robot would have let me bring a hypodermic to him, or a stethoscope, or a microscope?"
"Of course, I see your point," said Fastolf.
He looked at R. Daniil and gestured slightly. R. Daniil touched the cuff of his right shirt sleeve, and the diamagnetic seam fell apart the entire length of his arm. A smooth, sinewy, and apparently entirely human limb lay exposed. Its short bronze hair, both in quantity and distribution, were exactly what one would expect of a human being. Bailey said,
"So?"
R. Daniil pinched the ball of his right middle finger with the thumb and forefinger of his left hand. Exactly what the details of the manipulation that followed were, Bailey could not see. But just as the fabric of the sleeve had fallen in two when the diamagnetic field of its seam had been interrupted, so now the arm itself fell in two. There, under a thin layer of flesh-like material, was the dull blue-gray of stainless steel rods, cords, and joints.
"Would you care to examine Daniil's workings more closely, Mr. Bailey?"
asked Dr. Fastolf politely. Bailey could scarcely hear the remark, for the buzzing in his ears, and for the sudden jarring of the commissioner's high-pitched and hysterical laughter.